Good morning. Welcome to Holden. Today's date is August 22nd, 2002. Today's session is titled Economic Globalization and Neighbor Love, presented by Cynthia Mo'o-Labida, number MOC 2002-07. Let's listen in.
Topic of the subject, but they have an opposite side and just feel embarrassed that they'll be pointed at as apostates or disbelievers or bad people. And in our conversation, we thought, you know, we really have an obligation to speak our view rather than just remain silent. Sure. That's the end of my pre-comment.
Well, thank you. That's a good pre-comment. I respond to that in two ways. First of all, please don't feel afraid or apologetic or undesirous of expressing your view. It is just so firmly my belief that there's no fruit. There's very little fruit in talking when people all agree with each other. And that, given that we have minds and that we have varying experiences and that a great deal of wisdom gets brought to the discussion by everybody. There's just so much to say about that. The power of, I'm a part of a church community, obviously a congregation, and I see so clearly there the vast difference in perspectives, theological, political. I mean, everybody looks just the same practically, and yet the difference is so great. And it's so clear to me that the health of that community depends upon us talking our differences. The second thing I want to say, and this is all pre-comment, obviously, is that we are enormously constrained by this context of 1 hour. And I'm in a bit of a bind that my preferred way of teaching is very dialogical, that we're in conversation. On the other hand, I feel like there are some people here, and many of you have told me that, but you want to hear some things presented.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I'm sort of in a bind there. And that's a complaint to no one. It's no complaint. It's only a blessing that we're here discussing these things. But we are constrained by time in that sense. So let's try to work a balance there between the being in a paradoxical position of the best that can come of this is conversation between difference. And yet we're in a little bind also that there are many who want some material presented.
Yeah.
So if that would be my response to your pre-comment. I hope that the tapers picked up that was a pre-comment. We will begin. My name is Cynthia Mo'o-Labida, and this is the third in 5 sessions looking at economic globalization in light of Christian neighbor love. In the first session, we did a kind of overview of the sessions and a bit of an overview of the whole dilemma of being called, of having been given the vocation in life to love self and neighbor and God and earth, and yet being locked into, perhaps against our desires and our wills, ways of life that exploit neighbors around the globe, as well as the earth. So in the first session, we just pondered that grand contradiction. I realized in reflecting on these sessions one thing that I forgot to say about that, and that is that I understand theologically that the call to love neighbor, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, is not only, in ethics we talk about various categories, and one is obligation. The call to love neighbor, I do not theologically understand principally as an obligation, but as a gift. In other words, that we are given the love of God for us, and we are put in right relationship with God, and we are given a way of life that is loving God and loving neighbor. So I wanted to make that clear, and I do want to reread just the one little bit of Luther. And I think Luther is so stunning in his sense of neighbor love not as obligation, but as gift. Luther says in one of his writings, it's the sacrament of the body and blood of Christ. He says that there are two principles of Christian faith. The first, and I quote, "The first principle is that Christ gave himself that we may be saved, and we are saved by no effort of our own." No, that was me paraphrasing Luther, excuse me. That was the first principle in my paraphrase. The second, and here I quote Luther, is love. "As he gives himself for us, so we too are to give ourselves with might and main for our neighbor," unquote. Luther insists upon the inseparability of these two. The gift of God's saving love for us through no merit or effort of our own, and the gift of our living toward love for neighbor. He says these two principles are, I quote, "inscribed together as on a tablet which is always before our eyes and which we use daily." So I simply wanted to note that and to have us sit with the idea that this is a gift that we are to unravel and to claim, not an obligation that we are to be burdened by. Now, that is all somewhat to situate this session in our first session and in our purpose for these five sessions. In our second hour together, which was yesterday, we really responded to the reality that globalization is a word that is used by people to mean just about anything. And as the political theorist, who was it, Robert Dahl said, a word that can mean anything means nothing. So we looked at the fact that we need to be specific about what we're talking about when we use the word globalization. And I suggested seven, what I call defining trends, seven dynamics that constitute, in broad terms, the prevailing form of economic globalization today. And we worked at looking at those last time together. Now today, we move into our third session together. And I want to look at another paradox. Many, many people have been raised out of poverty by the form of economic globalization that we are looking at. One of the labels that we've used is corporate and finance-driven globalization. Other words for it are liberalization, market openness, free trade and investment. These all refer to the movement of economic globalization that we're discussing. It is indeed true that this form of economy, which is roughly a decade and a half old, maybe it's say 2 decades old, has lifted many people out of poverty and created tremendous wealth for many others. At the same time, there is a broad cacophony of voices, the world around, that claim it is widening the gap between the rich and the poor, making some poorer, 2, 3, endangering Earth's ecosystems, Earth's capacity to regenerate life, 4, undoing cultural diversity and integrity, and 5, endangering democracy. A whole plethora of voices are making those claims. So a question before us, I would suggest, two questions before us is why the two different claims, what explains the fact that many, many, many have gained, and yet, many, many voices also express that they and others are suffering? How do we explain that? Secondly, and more important for today, how do we explain the fact that, as a society, we buy into this form of economic life? In spite of the fact that myriad voices around the world are crying out against it, crying out so strongly that some are, you know, you've heard about Indian farmers burning themselves in protest against economic globalization. You've heard about South Dakota farmers and Canadian farmers on the borders protesting together. You've heard the wide range of voices, including right here in our own country. What explains that we so, as a society, unthinkingly buy into this? I would like us to have a day to look at that question. Given that we have an hour, I want to lead us a particular direction, and I want to suggest that there are certain beliefs or ideas that we hold uncritically and that we hold rather vehemently, and that by holding these ideas uncritically, we are led to accept economic globalization as it is. The power of ideas is profound. I want to read to you just one quote. Does anyone know the name Frances Moore LePage?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Diet for a Small Planet. What was the other one? Well, a major thinker and writer and activist around hunger globally. And let me tell you, this question of why we buy into it, in spite of that we know that there are tremendous problems, is a question that has burned within me for years now. And in struggling with it, one of my responses is we believe certain things uncritically that may or may not be true. Frances Moore LePage, struggling with the same question, wanting the question of untangling forces that enable us to comply with economic globalization, writes this. She says, "What could be powerful enough to allow us to tolerate, to accept, to acquiesce to millions of silent deaths by hunger every year? What could possibly explain our ability to condone such a status quo? I've finally come to believe," this is still LePage, "I have finally come to believe that there is only one thing powerful enough. It is the power of ideas. The ideas we hold about ourselves and our relationships to one another. It is these ideas that allow us to condone or even to support with tax dollars that which we as individuals abhor, and somehow to tolerate the discomforting contrast." Her conclusion there, that particular ideas allow us to live with this contradiction, is a conclusion I share. And I would suggest that there are many of these ideas. Two of them that are particularly strong we will look at here. One for tomorrow is our ideas about freedom and democracy. The one I would like us to examine together today is our ideas about economic growth. Does that sit well? Questions thus far? Let's take a look at the main idea, or theory, or presupposition undergirding economic globalization as it's unfolding today. It is the presupposition that, and this is very simply said, it's the presupposition that globalization, centered in free or deregulated trade and investment, leads to growth, which benefits all. Is that fairly clear? Globalization, as we looked at it yesterday, leads to growth, and growth, so part one, globalization leads to growth. And remember, when I say globalization now, I'm talking about the dynamics we talked about yesterday, which really come to their intersection point, their pivotal point in the deregulation of all aspects of trade and investment. Globalization leads to growth. Two, growth is good for everyone. That's the theory undergirding this form of economic life.
Growth,
yes.
Is that economic growth? Is that what you mean by
yes,
growth?
Thank you. I mean economic growth. That's a very important clarification. What is economic growth? Can anyone define it very succinctly?
Some people think it's just a rising GNP, gross national product. That's growth.
And actually today we use GDP, but you're right, more than GNP, gross domestic product. You're right, that is the most frequently used measure of economic growth, and it refers to an increase in the amount of goods and services produced and paid for. It can be measured by per capita household income or wealth, and it is often measured in terms of average. When it's measured in terms of per capita or household income or wealth, it's measured in terms of averages. So thank you, it's economic growth that we're looking at, not regular growth. This claim, as I noted it earlier, that globalization centered in free trade and investment leads to growth,
which leads to greater economic well-being for all, has to, well, let me go backwards just a minute, how are we going to do this? Well, let's stick there. We noted two clauses. I want you to do a little exercise. I want to read to you a statement about a statement of this theory as it is, as it comes out in some of the literature. And as you hear it, I want you to think. And I want you to think about, what do I agree with? What rings true here? What do I disagree with? And what fault lines are running through this theory, okay? Three questions. What do I agree with? What do I disagree with, and what fault lines do I see running through this theory? Succinctly stated, and this is stated by the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is an organization of representing the 29 most industrialized nations. Here's a statement. They've produced a book, a lot of literature, one of the main sources of literature on market openness, on free trade and investment, and one of them is called Open Markets Matter. And that you could look up on the internet if you wanted to get it. I quote, in short, open markets allow resources to be used more efficiently and productively. This contributes to growth and hence rising incomes. Open trade and investment helps firms tap into world markets, increases their sales potential, and realize economies of scale. Each of these improves profit, which sustains employment and investment. Market openness brings real direct economic gains to all consumers, whether firms or individuals. That was the most pithy, succinct statement that I could find in the book for us to look at. Do you need me to read it again?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a little slower.
Slower, thank you, I will do so. In short, open markets allow resources to be used more efficiently and productively. This contributes to economic growth and hence rising incomes. Open trade and investment helps firms tap into world markets, increase their sales potential, realize economies of scale. Each of these improves profit, which sustains employment and investment. Market openness brings real, direct economic gains to all consumers, whether firms or individuals. That's on page 40, if anyone wants to get that book. Now, this, again, is a statement explicating the fact, the theory that open markets produce growth, growth helps everyone. Can you point to falsities and truths, as you understand them, in that justification? Yes.
And your name is? Oh, Jennifer.
Jennifer.
It doesn't deal with the long-term costs that the Earth is bearing. For instance, the strip mining that's taking place on the East Coast for coal. Believe that it allows the profit to mine it to be, you know, maybe a 10% savings. But they're literally blasting off the tops of mountains and throwing it into the valleys, which is causing pollution.
Okay. So you're saying that the claim that benefits are there for all may be very true in the short term.
In the short term.
But not looking at the long-term implications. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that would be perhaps a fault line to investigate in that theory.
Okay.
If we were setting out in a room of people, that's where we are, people in a room of people, and we're setting out to say, if this is the theory undergirding the economy as it is unfolding, let us at least test it out. Let us at least question it. All right, that's one concern, yes.
Another way to say what Jennifer said is the economic system is not bringing into its equation the ecological costs.
Okay. Does anyone know the term? Is anyone in here an economist that knows the term that we use for costs that aren't counted in the economic, the financial balance of an operating firm? It's called externalizing costs. Mm-hmm. It's costs that are kept external to the
equation.
The equation, right. So how did you put it? Not, well, why don't I just put externalizing ecological costs?
Yeah,
sure.
Could I say that?
Okay.
All right, other ways that externalizing. All right, other fault lines that you see in this theory or truths in the theory? Two hands, yes?
What you were reading there is really based a lot on internet, and that's what allows these things to take place. Everything that you read was absolutely true for those who are wired, but many are not and are left out of what you were describing.
You're saying it's based on internet. I'm not sure what you mean.
This new communication is what allows the instantaneous transfer of money, business deals.
I see.
Israel right now no longer sells oranges, okay. And they don't even have any products in large part. They're doing coding for computers and sending it by modem back off to someplace else. But only those people that are plugged in are benefiting this way.
Okay. All right. And that, thank you. That's something I haven't thought about a lot. But it's a very important point to put up. You're saying that there's a differential between those who are able to, the internet is a part of this economic functioning, and those who don't have access to it are left out of it.
It's a huge part,
yes. Okay.
And I have comment on the first comment up there about mountaintop mining in West Virginia right now. Uh-huh. That's been going on for a century. It has nothing to do with globalization today. I just came back from living in that area, and the historical strip mining and mountaintop mining has been going on for before the 1900s.
Oh, but it isn't helping it.
True, it's not helping. It's disastrous, it's ruining, but it has nothing to do with global
warming. Well, it does. I use that just as an isolated sample because there's like clear cutting that takes place on Indonesian islands that follow the same model, because if you go in and chop, then you've got a short-term profit, but you're not looking at the long-term degradation.
So interestingly enough, the both bear truth there, that your point that mining and using the Earth's resources without thinking about the long-term costs has gone on for a long time. You're saying there's a new reality entailed in that with globalization, and that is that, say, a firm based in the UK can strip mine or deforest in the Philippines and not see the consequences, but can bear the short-term profits.
Exactly.
So that's an important nuance.
That's valid.
Okay.
That's valid.
Yes.
You're talking about deficiencies in the market.
Uh-huh.
And generally speaking, if you take a look at the way we started out in the timber business in the
uh-huh.
Northwest,
uh-huh.
cutting a few trees here, private family mills or whatever,
uh-huh.
and they would bring them to market, they would hire people. As these firms got bought up, you had more efficient operations,
uh-huh.
and efficiency was defined in terms of not putting money into the community, but rapidly putting money into the pocket of the enterprise that was doing this. So, and they would, their efficiency of scale would be such that it would allow for strip forestation, deforestation of the Philippines.
Okay.
So the efficiencies actually strike at the very heart of the ability to earn income from the resource that the land bears.
Okay. So you're saying efficiency might not necessarily be something to be valued and sought after.
Yeah.
That efficiency might hide deep, deep problems. Okay, is that what you're saying?
Right.
Now, that's not to say that efficiency is never good or that some forms of efficiency are not good, but you're saying that efficiency, uncritically accepted as a good, is problematic.
Right.
Okay. Someone I read once said it was an economist from the Philippines who was obviously used to people being laborers being misused, said efficiency is getting the most number of people to do the most undesirable work for the least benefit to themselves for the longest time you can. So, something to that effect, which is sort of a way of pointing to what you're saying. Yes.
It divides the employment. People who are prepared and very bright can move into these jobs with efficiency. People who are marginal oftentimes are left unemployed and homeless.
Okay, say that again. Just say it again.
People who are bright and educated move into jobs for the globalization. Uh-huh. But people who are marginal in their abilities cannot find jobs, or their jobs are so menial they cannot earn an adequate living.
So you're saying it leaves out people who are marginally equipped?
Yes.
To get into this whole scheme of things. Okay, all right. Yes, John.
I guess I could argue the opposite too, that if it's, there are countries that have never had capital in them before, and with an open economy, open society, you're able to move capital to countries that then can provide jobs. And it goes there because it's less expensive, less costly to do the labor in Nicaragua as it is in Pittsburgh.
So
it can provide jobs to people that otherwise would not have them. Capital wouldn't be invested there.
But so a plus, just to make sure I know what you're saying, a plus of globalization, as we're talking about it, is that it can bring jobs to areas that otherwise would not have jobs and capital to areas that would not have it. Is that a summary?
Yeah.
But rob jobs from other areas.
And do it only for profit.
Well, let's think about it.
No, just a minute. Your tennis shoes. Or were they made what you paid for them? What would you have paid for them if they were made in Chicago?
I wouldn't buy them.
Would you pay $180 for them as opposed to $35? That's the question.
The only for profit. I'm not sure who said that.
I did.
That can be claimed, and that can be true in many cases. But if we're looking at this whole picture, I think we need to take seriously also the fact that many, let's say, impoverished countries are seeking and looking for international investment specifically for the purpose of jobs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So to not acknowledge that would not to be taking a fair look at what we're taking a look at. We need to, so let's say, for instance, I worked with a theologian in South Africa who was also an economist. And the last time we met, he talked about the detailed planning they're doing to get international investment into the company. And this is a fairly leftist, radical theologian and economist. They're working to get investment, foreign investment into the country for the purpose of jobs. So let us hold on to that and see how that relates to the rest of what we're talking about. Does that make sense? Yes.
Kind of a different angle. I'm intrigued by part of the assumption in this is that economic growth usually is to have more things, although often it is services and goods and services, but I think so much of it is driven by things. And I guess part of this, what I'm trying to say, which isn't too well conceived, is that like living simply is a whole different perspective, that we don't need as many things. And of course, I think our urge to have these things is driven a great deal by advertising, the propaganda of capitalism, which I call mind pollution. Could you imagine if instead on television, instead of seeing all those ads, you saw messages about how to increase family harmony? If you saw hints on how to have a better marriage or whatever, that came to you every 30, for 30 second messages about, what is it, about 45 times an hour you see on television, you see an ad, I don't know how many.
Okay.
They're all, but a totally different perspective.
Okay.
This is so.
So, and many economic theorists today would say that advanced global capitalism is not production driven as was classical capitalism as much as consumption driven. But your point is that one fault line might be that this is predicated upon the need for increasing consumption, and that there are questions about the viability of increasing consumption.
Right.
Is that what you're saying?
Not just the viability of it, but maybe even the desirability.
Okay. Oh, and the other thing you're saying is that it's based upon creating desires.
Exactly.
And that creating increasing desires might be destructive for a greater sense of well-being.
Yeah.
Now, we need to hold on to those as two fault lines. Let's remember as we do so that we're doing this from the perspective of the consuming world. Mm-hmm. From the perspective of the non-consuming world, where the problem is not massive overconsumption, but is underconsumption, then the aim is to enable consumption, adequate caloric consumption, adequate nutritional consumption. So let's remember that we're very perspectival in naming those important issues. Yes, Karen.
It seems to me that I don't see a problem with companies doing business overseas and things like that, and helping to create jobs in countries where there are very few. However, I think that all needs to be balanced with countries taking responsibility to watch out for the best interests of their citizens. And so it seems to me that the key here is the degree of deregulation can be a problem, where companies are allowed to come into countries and take unfair advantage of those resources just because the land is cheap. So it seems like that's got to be the crux of this, is how do you balance wanting to create economic opportunity in different parts around the world, mm-hmm. with the same need to protect the mm-hmm. natural resources mm-hmm. and the human rights mm-hmm. of the people in those countries, mm-hmm. and that's where it's the responsibility of government to protect those people. And then you've got countries where government's not interested in those protections, and then we run into problems. They're not interested in protecting the environment, and maybe they're so desperate to create economic opportunity that they're not interested in protecting the environment, or they're not interested in human rights because there are problems within the government in terms of people.
Okay,
you know,
so you're in part
taking your advantage of power.
That's a very useful comment in speaking to, I think, what you were speaking to, John, to a certain extent, that you're trying to hold up this possible positive of enabling jobs,
right.
You're trying to hold that in juxtaposition with the fact that sometimes the problems are larger than the benefit of the jobs. And you're saying that one key might be the terms under which international investment comes in.
Yes, exactly.
And that the key to establishing terms might be governments mm-hmm. having the right to determine conditions under which international investment comes in. Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Governments, international agreements, things like that.
Governments, international agreements, local, national, state
governments. Local, national, state governments.
Okay, let's hold that on. If we had a wall full of paper here, we could name that as possibly one key to look at when we're looking at alternatives. Yes, Janelle.
I think of campesino farmers in Mexico,
mm-hmm.
and when they can't compete with huge agricultural mm-hmm. business coming into Mexico, mm-hmm. an entire way of life is lost.
Mm-hmm.
Of living, you know, with the land mm-hmm. and sort of subsistence, mm-hmm. you know, farming. When they can't compete with the prices mm-hmm. of the cheaper products or whatever, then they become displaced and they go to the cities. Well, they've lost that connection to the land. They've lost that community. They've lost their whole way of life. And I think that is a casualty of economic growth.
Okay, so one casualty is that, say it very simply so I can put it on the board.
Small-scale farming. I mean,
loss of small-scale farming. That's
right.
Part of what you're saying.
Right.
And also loss of subsistence, small-scale
right.
and subsistence farming,
right, yeah.
due to incoming cheap imports.
Right.
Okay.
Would that go under loss of cultural diversity?
Well,
let's
put them both down. Also small-scale, and when I say small-scale, it's including that subsistence. And then cultural diversity.
Now, as one important thing when we're naming fault lines or problems is to remember that you can't just name problems and fault lines without also thinking about what might be alternatives. And for every time that people in, say, two-thirds world countries have named some of these problems, they're doing so in the context of also naming alternatives. So let's keep that in the back of our minds also. This is a wonderful list. Seeing no other hands up, let me just run through some of the thoughts that I had and see if there's anything that didn't get put up here. I think you've pretty much pointed to much of what I wanted to suggest. Let's see. Okay, here's how I want to frame what was just done there. I want to suggest to you that the first clause in that theory is true. It's largely true that free trade and investment, liberalized trade and investment, open markets on a global scale create economic growth. I want to suggest to you that the second clause is not necessarily true. That economic growth does not necessarily mean well-being for all, increased well-being for all. I think that's what you have been pointing to in your list of fault lines with the theory. I think you haven't been finding any problems with the notion that that free markets increase growth. You've been finding problems with the notion that growth necessarily is beneficial for all. So if we want to look at that, I would suggest to you that there are two major fault lines. And one of them is just that, that the presupposition or the claim that economic growth is necessarily good is not necessarily true. The second fault line, and then we're going to go through a bunch of those, which you put up here. The second fault line that I hope we get to also is that this whole theory draws upon the classical theorists of capitalism, John Smith and David Ricardo, the classical theorists of capitalism. However, this theory betrays and dismantles the theories that Adam Smith and David Ricardo developed and used In other words, open markets matter, the book that I quoted to you, remember the little quote that we thought about, literally says this all holds true today as much as it did when Adam Smith and David Ricardo first developed the theory. It says that. I'm paraphrasing, but it's an accurate paraphrase. However, so it's drawing upon Smith and Ricardo to justify open markets, but it's undoing some of the things that Smith and Ricardo said need to be in place in order for capitalism to work. So I want to go into that also. Mm-hmm. Two sets of problems. All right, moving to the first set of problems, which is the one that you all have looked at very closely here. Growth doesn't necessarily mean well-being. First, and you mentioned it back here, growth as measured by GDP simply fails to account for the social and ecological costs of growth. It doesn't distinguish between destructive and sustaining economic activity. In other words, as you said back here in the gray shirt, the more consumptive a lifestyle is, the more it makes for growth. So the more car wrecks we have, the more alcoholics we have, the more tobacco we sell to kids, the more pornography we sell, the more violent video games we produce and sell, that all makes for growth. Which is one reason to see a problem with growth equals well-being for all. Similarly, indicators of family or community breakdown measure as growth. Just what I said, those are all indicators of some degrees of individual and family breakdown. Long-term costs, and this all fits into this one problem of failing to account for the social and ecological costs of growth. Long-term ecological depletion is not considered in growth figures. Are you the person that brought that up? I'll bring you a quote from the former president of the World Bank, Barbara Conable. He says this, GDP figures, that is growth figures, are generally used without the caveat that they represent an income that cannot be sustained.
They ignore the degradation of the natural resource base and view the sale of non-renewable resources entirely as income. Unquote. That is, just as we said, if a corporation comes in and clear cuts a forest in the Philippines, the people that then cannot survive because they lived on the forest.
The fishing, all over the world, the fish are being, they're not going to be more fish in the world if they're not careful. They're overfishing, all the fishing.
Okay. And the point here would simply be, remember, we're just getting tools here for saying, does this growth theory really work? Okay. Secondly, growth is not an adequate indicator of economic well-being because it doesn't take into account distribution of wealth and income. Growth in terms of GDP, or average household income or wealth, often obscures an accompanying increase in poverty. Look at this little example. Economists claim growth in the U.S. economy between 83 and 98, based upon a 22.2% average household in 22.2% increase in average household net worth. That's 83 to 98. Yet remember increasing numbers of homeless people, including kids on the street, increasing numbers of people without health care. It didn't feel like up through 98 we were becoming wealthier as a society. So what would explain that? Yes?
Things cost more.
Things cost more?
Absolutely.
Okay. That is an interesting explanation. The one that I was thinking about is just that while we did have a 22.2% increase in average household net worth, we had a 10% decrease in median household net worth. So if you have 10 people in a room, say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, you 11 people in the front row are putzing around in your economic lives and living. But if you two all of a sudden become billionaires, and you nine, your income goes way down, it's still going to register as growth.
High average, yes.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
So aside from any valuation of globalization or whatever, this is a reason to question the growth thing. All right? That one makes it. One quick third piece of this one fault line. And again, the fault line is, maybe growth does not necessarily mean improved well-being for all. A third reason to question that. This one is so amazing. Growth as measured by GDP. Remember we used to say GNP? Does that ring a bell? And now we say GDP. I can't remember the year it changed in international measurements. But growth as GDP is an inadequate measure of economic well-being for all because GDP attributes to a host country income that is repatriated from that country to the home country of a corporation. Yep. Now let me say that differently. If I'm a particular corporation and I'm based in Norway and I invest in Guatemala and make a great deal of profit and bring most of that profit back to Norway, although leave some of it here because I've paid because I've left some profit here in Guatemala, the profit that I bring back to Norway under GDP, guess what country it counts for?
Norway.
Guatemala.
Yeah. Oh. But even though they don't have the money.
Exactly. Now hear that. Think about the implications of that. So if statistics say, but the economy of A, B, C, D countries has grown under globalization, the economy of this country, that country, that country has grown, Haiti, but if a significant portion of that growth is actually profit made by, get into bad guy, good guy stuff, but is made by 6 or 7 different international corporations and is expatriated back to the US or France or Japan or wherever else,
hasn't, that repatriated profit, it's a deceptive figure.
Yeah, that's very deceptive.
Is there clarity, is there conceptual clarity about that? Because I know I'm being a little jumbled here in my words.
We get it.
That's the third piece of this fault line. So if indeed, and I challenge you in the next month to talk to people about the global economy, and I bet you $100 that you would hear people say in general, but the way we're doing things makes for growth. The economies of countries are growing. And now you see three or four things to just test about that theory of growth. That is the theory. Listen to the discourse, the public discourse. That's the theory undergirding the globalizing economy. It's why we believe, it's one of the reasons we believe as a society that it's good, because it's making for growth. Now, these are just some little cracks or fault lines in that theory to consider. Shall we go into the second fault line, or do you want to process
them? Yes.
Okay. The second major fault line running through the argument that globalization is good for all because it leads to growth is this. As I said earlier in introducing this segment, it explicitly appeals to Adam Smith and David Ricardo. Adam Smith is the father of free market theory. David Ricardo is the father of free trade theory. We appeal, or the theorists of globalization appeal to them to justify free trade and investment. Doing so, I submit, is invalid, because free trade and investment, as it is happening today, dismantles conditions that both Smith and Ricardo presuppose and prescribe for their theories to work. In other words, there are particular conditions that they said, that they assumed would be in place or said need to be in place for free market theory and free trade theory to work. And globalization is dismantling some of those. A couple of examples, and there are many of them. The theory of comparative advantage. Does anyone know the theory of comparative advantage? The theory of comparative advantage is the grounding of free trade theory. And it simply says that if all nations specialize in producing what they can produce at a lower opportunity cost than their trading partners, everyone will benefit. In other words, if you're a nation and you're a nation and you produce apples and you can do it at a lower opportunity cost than you can, but you can produce oranges at a lower opportunity cost than you can, then your economies are both going to grow. If you produce apples, you produce oranges, and you trade them. That's the theory. And in its context, and without certain other circumstances, it certainly works. Now, Ricardo said a few things and presupposed certain things in developing that theory. And one of them was that if investment moved from country to company, from country to country, the theory wouldn't work. Because wages would decline, keep on declining. He said that if in the production of apples here, oranges here, coffee here, shoes here, cookies here, da 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 da, if capital moved from this country to this country, the theory would unravel, because wages would go down to the lowest, to the wages in the lowest country. Now, today, the most powerful aspect of globalization currently is the movement of capital from country to country. The international treaties that are being developed around globalization are written to enable the free flow of capital, from investment capital, from country to country. So we're appealing to, we're saying, free trade theory, David Ricardo, to support agreements and mechanisms of globalization that undo that condition that he presupposed,
which was capital isn't going to move from country to country. One of the complaints, one of the cries against economic globalization on many fronts is that it does exactly what Ricardo predicted, that wages keep declining. A symbol of that is an ad, the pre-NAFTA ad, I can't remember what newspaper it was in, but I think it was a Minneapolis newspaper, that you could hire, you know, invest in Mexico because you can hire Rosa Gonzalez for 57 cents or 78 cents an hour, something like that. Post-NAFTA, the same ad came out, and it said invest in Mexico because you can hire Rosa Galvez for 58 cents an hour. In other words, the declining wages. Am I making sense?
Yeah, but what causes that?
Wages to decline?
Yeah. Because people will work for less and less just to have a job?
Because if I am bound, if I need to make the most I can make, and here let's not even, you know, blame a company, let's blame Wall Street on this. If I need to make the most I can make in order to stay viable as a company, then why hire you to do my work in the U.S., in Detroit? Why not hire someone on the border of Mexico who can do the work for a tenth as much? Now, 5 years later, when someone on the border of Mexico organizes and gets better equipped, or say, hire someone in Ireland who will work it for less. But then 5 years later, when the Irish organize and they want better wages and they want benefits, then I can take my company and I can move it to another country.
Okay.
That's why wages keep. Okay. The CEO, I've got a wonderful quote, the CEO of, I think, General Electric said, ideally you would have every plant on a barge. Meaning you could move every plant to where wages were cheapest. Now that doesn't mean that every company is doing this. You, as I am, are probably well aware of corporations who have chosen otherwise. You know, have chosen to be socially responsible. Is anyone here involved in some of the networks of socially responsible investing and business? There are national networks of, and I've been to an award banquet and I can't remember the name of one, networks of corporations seeking to undo that kind of practice. So we see, and that is one of the incredible movements in place. So we're not saying universally this is what's done. We're saying this is what the system is set up to do, and that the current negotiations underway are making it all the easier to do this, are opening markets for trade and capital. We're not saying this is necessarily what all corporations are doing. Yes.
Good example of watching that movement is a lot of the programming that's done in the software industry. It moved out of the United States to India first because of the education there. It's now gone to places like Indonesia and Sri Lanka. And it just moves wherever the cost of the labor is the lowest.
Okay, I didn't know about that example, but that's a very good one, and that rings very, very true.
But that means building the factories and training the people in that cost thing, that is amazing that they think they can save money, keep moving country to country.
Well, except there's very little infrastructure. I mean, all you have to have is a PC.
Yes.
We put the blame. You use the phrase. Well, let's blame Wall Street.
Well, I don't want to put blame any place.
But you know, that's been a theme I hear. You know, corporations said with a tone of the voice. Almost everybody here has tennis-type shoes. I'll bet, except for New Balance, they're all made in these developing countries. It's we, the consumers, educated, intelligent people that really are the driving engine for this. There's not been marketing for dope in this country. It's because we seek dope. Nobody here smokes dope, but Americans smoke dope.
You know, but go on with your point is a good point.
Yeah, we bring it in, invite it.
I don't know about the dope point that you made, but the first thing that you said, we're all wearing tennis shoes, and they were all made in just the circumstances we're talking about. That is a very, very good point. Remember what we talked about, the language I used in the beginning about being locked into, or in bondage to or enslaved to, we are locked into a system in which our tennis shoes get made someplace where some boy is going to go, or my kid's soccer balls. You know, my kid's playing with soccer balls. Those soccer balls are made maybe by a boy in India who will be blind by the, before he's out of his teens, because he's been sewing soccer balls all day because he has to have a job. Now, why does he have to have a job sewing soccer balls? He has to have a job sewing soccer balls because seven countries own mines that are mining the bauxite out of northern India, and in doing so, displacing myriads of tribal people and Dalit people and fisher folk. So they have to leave the mines and they have to go to the city. They have to leave their lands. They had lived on their lands for generations and had been fed and clothed and healthy. And then the mining companies came in and the people are pushed off their lands, and when they protest, they're killed. And I'm telling you this story because of an Indian Lutheran church worker with whom I work that has described this story on and on. I'm saying yes about your tennis shoe example. We're locked in. And I'm saying slowly, conceivably, as people of neighbor love, we can unwind it. Now, we happen to also, people, not people of neighbor love, people called to and given neighbor love, maybe we can set our lives on a course that for the next series of years, going on beyond our lifespans, probably, we can shift this. Now, that little, and I'm going to call on you in half a minute, that little example I just gave about the mines when I went rattling off at the mouth here, I like to bring up because of the fact that it also is a glimmer of hope. There's been tremendous organizing in India against those bauxite mines, by which we have a lot of metal products in our households. You know, we use that bauxite in our households. A lot of organizing, a lot of it church-based organizing, ecumenical organizing, and one of the things that happened is Norway, one of the seven countries that had investments in the mines, began to listen, has disinvested in those mines, and is working with the people who have been protesting to reestablish them on lands. So I'm just saying there are examples of organizing that pays off. Mm-hmm. Yes, in the back.
I take a little different perspective on one aspect of that, which mm-hmm. is, you know, certainly there's some truth to why some 10-year-old boy has mm-hmm. to leave and live on the streets of Calcutta and, mm-hmm. and suffer a great deal. But I think a far greater reason mm-hmm. for that, rather than evil corporations, mm-hmm. although I believe some corporations are fairly mm-hmm. evil, and maybe, in fact, just the way they're structured is mm-hmm. unfortunately mm-hmm. not beneficial. But I think you have to look at modern medicine as maybe a greater cause mm-hmm. of those problems. Mm-hmm. That we have, of course, the population explosion that's happening still in many parts of the world. And some of the reality of that is simply the land can't carry that many people. And so in many rural areas, as the population rises, people naturally move to the cities because often the opportunities in cities, although they're grim, are often a little less grim than the country. So
you're saying, the main thing you're saying is that population growth is mm-hmm. another factor in here.
Not just a little factor either. I think it's actually more significant than evil corporations.
Well, if you'll remember in the very beginning when I said that Earth's natural limits, we've moved beyond Earth's natural limits. I said economic globalization together with population growth.
Oh, well.
And that is very, very real. Now, and not only real, but a major factor. Mm-hmm. The interplay between economic globalization and population growth would be another thing for us to pursue. But for now, let's just say yes. And let's remember that, let's hold that up for another major question. I did a talk last year for, what's that organization? One of the big population growth organizations. I mean, anti-population
growth. DPG, maybe?
I honestly can't remember. It was in Seattle. And one of the things, well, let's not hold it. Let's just hold that up as important and say, one of the things we need to question is why population growth, and what might be some of the interplays between globalization and population growth.
But, you know, just population growth is not just babies being born, it's people living longer. People are, a lot more people are healthier now and they're living longer.
Yeah.
And we're having, in a lot of countries, they're having less babies being born.
Okay, I sort of don't want us to get us down that track because I feel like we're going to get off other tracks.
Number two of things that are conditions for free market and trade to exist is.
Pardon me?
Before we move on, I do want to say yes to what you said about population growth. To look at economic globalization as a causal factor of increasing gap between rich and poor, ecological destruction, and poverty, and not name population growth also would be very mystifying and falsifying. Secondly, in response to what you said, I do want to nuance a little bit what I'm saying. I am not trying to point to evil corporations or evil Wall Street. I'm really trying to point more to a whole way of economic life that is led, let us say, by the consumer motor of the economically privileged world and the corporations we have created, we invest in, we benefit from, and our financial structure. Mm-hmm. But I'm not trying to say the evil resides here or the evil resides there, which is,
I totally agree with you. I was sort of being playful when I called evil corporations, but I totally agree that it's really the system.
And the danger of saying it's the system is then we think we can't do anything.
Right, but there can be modifications and changes to the system. But it is the structural change that we need, not so much that we need to, you know, get rid of seven CEOs, but.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And the structural change is let's just say yes. I would say the structural change includes our very concepts of what economic life is.
Yeah.
You know, for instance, we have assumed that economic life is for the maximum production of goods and services, that we maximize production of goods and services. Maybe we need to think about economic life more in terms of the Greek word for economy, oikonomia, is also the root word for ecumenical and the root word for ecology. Maybe we need to rethink, maybe part of our great work of our day is to think that economic life is for the management of the whole household of God, for the ongoing sustainable management of human life inside the greater economy of Earth. That there isn't a human economy here and an Earth economy here, but the human economy is situated in a broader economy and has to live within it and not exceed it. So when we say structural change, I think it's conceptual change on the biggest level, and it's everyday practice change. And for us to think that our everyday practice changes are all we need, or for us to think that we don't need them and we just need big conceptual changes is a big mistake. It's a broad-based series of things when we talk about structural change. You asked for one more illustration and then we'll stop. And I'll just point out, you asked for one more illustration of the way we betray the theories of Smith and Ricardo upon which we draw to support free trade investment. Another is that, you know the term the free hand, what is it, the free hand of the market? What's the term?
Oh, the invisible hand. Adam Smith.
The invisible hand, excuse me, the invisible hand of the market, that's Adam Smith. And we read that as meaning that if you just keep the market flowing freely and don't do regulations of the market, that the laws of supply and demand will keep a healthy market. That his words, the invisible hand of the market, and his argument that it will work toward a healthy economy, is written in the very paragraph in which he both presupposes, that means he assumes, and he calls for investment to remain domestic.
That's insane, then.
And yet we use it to justify the freeing up
of investment to not be first domestic, but to be as rapid as possible, as speculatively as possible across national borders. That's just another example of the betrayal of Adam Smith. Adam Smith didn't write to create an economy. Well, Adam Smith wrote specifically in one of the books of his book, The Wealth of Nations, he writes that you've got to pay a worker enough to support himself, workers were or men in his world, and his family. That's part of what Adam Smith says. That's not one of the theories undergirding, say, the free trade zones in Mexico or the Philippines, but he writes that in his economic theory. So that's, again, just to go back to the request for examples of the second fault line, which is the drawing upon classical economic theory to support an economic system that betrays and dismantles the conditions that that theory presupposes.
It would be nice if every company paid enough money to each of their employees enough to live with the housing and the food and everything that they need to exist.
Okay, yes, and there are companies that are. So let's just remember that one alternative in place is that there are companies that are. Yes, it would be nice, and yes, there are some that are, and there are movements afoot. For instance, one public policy movement afoot in some places is a living wage movement. So instead of a minimum wage, we have a living wage, which is more. We need to close because we've gone way over time, and I want to hear, let's close with your comment.
It's just a question.
Yes.
Are there resources that indicate what some of these socially responsible companies are?
Yes, there are many resources out there. We subscribe to a journal called There's a journal called Boycott America. Co-op America. It's called Co-op America, which has a journal that lists a great deal of resources and ways that you can locate companies that are paying their employees enough, or that are worker-owned, or that are producing in ways that are not externaling the ecological cost of their production, so that as consumers, we can choose to buy our shoes and our shirts and our apples and our milk from companies that are deciding to live according to quite radical alternatives. There are many resources out there, and I'll try to bring with me some of those addresses tomorrow.
That would be helpful.
But I do know that if you looked on the internet, you could find Co-op America and go from there.
Co-op America.
Yeah, I know that's the journal. I know that's the name of the journal. Yes.
I'm Paul. Plant mutual funds, I believe they try to invest in socially responsible companies, so that might give some hints of companies too.
Good point. Good point. Okay, y'all have been wonderful, and I apologize that we went over, and thank you much.
You've been wonderful.
Oh, I do want to say that I did write a book out of it. If you're interested in it, it came out last week, and you can write down the name of it.
But it's not in the book.